Brandon and Jason wanted to do a little Lynyrd Skynyrd for the offertory. I said, no, just kind of doodle a little bit. So maybe next week. Quick, sit down before you break out in Freebird or something. Who wants world peace? Who is like pro world peace? Let me see the hands. Okay, so 30%. 30% of you are pro world peace, is what I'll say. My question is, why do you want world peace? Why do you want world peace? So we're going to take a quiz. Latest installment of the Nightlife Quiz. Do you want world peace? Because, A, it would make the world more livable. There was great debate as to whether the word livable had an E in it. You know, after the V. Livable. Well, B, because people who want world peace love people and do not want to ever see them harmed. You know, who would be the better seeker of world peace? Is it someone that would just like to make the world more livable for themselves? Or would the better seeker warrior for world peace be someone who loves people all over the world and doesn't want to see them harmed? Right? Slightly different. Think. A. B. Or is it C. Both? Both A and B. That world peace is good because it not only makes your world more livable, but nobody around the earth gets harmed. Which is it? Tastes great. Less filling. How many say A? You want world peace because it would make the world more livable. It'd be a lot nicer to live in a place where there weren't bombs going off.
None of the above.
What are you? I'm kind of a Grinch. All right, so a few A's. You're seeking world peace because, you know, the world would be nicer to live in. Okay, B, who wants world peace because you don't want to see anybody get harmed because you love everyone? Okay, four and a half of you choose B. All right, C, it would make the world more livable and you love everybody and don't want to see them harmed. How many C's do we have? All right, overwhelming majority C. All right, I'm with B. And here's why. The question was, who would be a better seeker of world peace? Who would be a better warrior for world peace? To the extent that you're motivated to seek world peace by A, making your world more livable, you wouldn't be willing to die for world peace, would you? Right? Because if you're just after making your living room nicer to be in, it's illogical for you to die for the cause. Because then, of course, you wouldn't be living in your living room. Now, would you? You'd be dead. Not caring a whit about your living room. I think that if A gets mixed in, then you're not willing to die for the cause. And of course, you know, world peace, it requires people willing to fight for the cause and also people willing to die for the cause. Yes, otherwise it won't advance. That's why I chose world peace. That was a plain one. Well, I think it's B. We'd like to say C, but I don't think we can't. It's one of those instances in which why we're pursuing something actually affects the way that we go after it. Right? If we're pursuing it for A or some mixture of A, we would only go so far. If we're pursuing it for B and purely B, then there's no limit. It's interesting. This is a nice mental exercise because, you know, when I first started thinking of the multiple choice questions, I thought, well C sounds attractive. And then you had to seek it through. And when you're thinking about world peace and why we're pursuing world peace, if you're anything like me, you think of the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Yeah.
Right? You think of the ivory-billed woodpecker. This is why I bring up the ivory-billed woodpecker. As you know, I'm like a world-class animal lover. I'm a conservationist. I'm like Mr. Green, you know, vegetarian and all that. And I remember when I was in grade school, when I was in fifth grade, and we had this ecology unit in my class. They were talking about extinction and the threat to habitat, that many animals were facing and how many species every year were going extinct, were disappearing from the planet. And in this particular film that we saw in the ecology unit, you remember the films I used to have in grade school, if those of you who are old enough, we actually didn't have DVDs. We had reel-to-reel films, right, that were made in 1951, right? And at any moment, they could burst into flame, which was, of course, always more fun than the film. But I remember watching this film on extinction, and they had a video from 1944 of the ivory-billed woodpecker. And the reason the video of, this video, I say, the film of the ivory-billed woodpecker was on this, in this movie, was because it was the last known sighting of an ivory-billed woodpecker. They had, their habitat had dwindled, they were a swamp dweller, and the waterlands had been eaten up in the southeast where they frequented, and it was, as far as anybody could tell, the last ivory-billed woodpecker alive. And the ivory-billed woodpecker had not been seen at all or heard. No nest had been found since 1946. And it just broke my heart. The ivory-billed woodpecker was sort of this, you know, this pretty big bird, actually, with a very prominent bill, as you would expect. And I remember watching that thing flap around on the film, and it just struck me. So for my whole life, whenever I think of animals going extinct, I think of the ivory-billed woodpecker. So why do you bring that up, Jordan? Because this week, scientists have published proof that the ivory-billed woodpecker is back. Yeah, it has been discovered. Yeah, give him a hand. You can go to CNN.com and you can read about the ivory-billed woodpecker. At first, they had some blurry video, and skeptics said, oh, that's not the ivory-billed woodpecker. It was from a swamp in Arkansas. One swamp in Arkansas. That's not the ivory-billed woodpecker. And so the scientists went back through their files. They had 17,000 hours of audio recordings from the swamp, and they produced snippets of the call of the ivory-billed woodpecker. In fact, two woodpeckers were recorded calling one to another. They had a very distinct call. So not been seen for 60 years. And ivory-billed woodpeckers are now alive in a swamp in Arkansas. Right? For 60 years, no one has seen them. And that sounds like a silly story to you. When I read this story, I actually cried. You know, because one, it's just because, you know, I love animals so much. But two, because the ivory-billed woodpecker had grown to great proportions in my psyche. Right? This was the poster child for extinction. This was a poster child for no more hope. For the end has come. It's over. Never again, right? The ivory-billed woodpecker meant that to me. And when I read the story, I just thought, that is so exciting. I can't tell you how happy that makes me. And I also thought that this is really why I get excited about heaven. This is a huge motivation for me in seeking after the Lord. Because that to me is like at the core of everything God promises, right? It's like, the end has come, it's over, there's no more hope, but wait. There's heaven, there's God, there's life after death. I think that's a huge part of my being and the way that I see the world. When I think about working in the world, about having a meaningful life, I think about trying to save, you know, creatures, you know, people from the end. The end from which there is no withdrawal. That's just part of who I am. That's a personal story. The ivory-billed woodpecker, there you are. Swamp in Arkansas. In junior high, I was challenged by a science teacher on my conservationist views. His name was Mr. Anderson. And he said, why do we care? We were talking about California condors at the time, which almost went extinct. Why do we care about condors? They're basically a vulture that live off of rotten meat on the highways of California. Why do we care? Would we be poor? Would the world be a poorer place if the condor left? After all, you know, countless thousands of species have gone extinct over the centuries. Would we be a poorer place? Why? And ecologists tend to have two answers to that question. One has to do with biodiversity, which is, we don't know exactly why losing the California condor would hurt us, would cost But we do know that the more biodiversity we have, the more different kinds of animals and the more different kinds of plants, the healthier the planet will be. That's sort of a scientific principle, biodiversity. I don't like that defense of ecology. There's another one which has to do with fundamental value. You know, I'll be sad if the condor disappears forever because I think the condor is valuable. You know, it's sort of a poverty of intrinsic nature. We will be poorer because there are no more condors. And this is a thing that Mr. Anderson, he didn't get it. This is a thing that I think you either get or you don't get. I cannot explain to you why the condor is fundamentally valuable. I can't. You either care about it or you don't care about it. Right? I can't give you the biodiversity argument. I can't rationalize it, justify it to you in any way except that the California condor is worth loving. It's worth protecting. You get it or you don't. So how many California condor voters do we have? How many don't care if the California condor ends up in as a burger in a diner somewhere? All right, we're introing a series tonight called Why Do We Do the Things We Do? And the theme of the series is going to be why do we do the things we do as people who are interested in Jesus? And we're going to take a look at things that are assumed in the life of investigating, exploring, following after Jesus. Things like, you know, why do we worship? Why do we pray? You know, have you ever really thought that through? I mean, obviously we do that. We've already done it tonight. We worship, we prayed. Why exactly do we do those things? And tonight we're going to look at what I think the first thing is. The first thing, if you're interested in following Jesus, you're going to confront is why do we seek? Why do we seek? You have to be a seeker to follow after God. Because if you just sit around and do nothing and play video games, you don't really advance in your quest for God or the truth or spiritual life, stuff like that. Why is it that to get close to God, we have to go after God? Right? Why isn't he knocking on our door? Why do we seek? Why do we seek? And I think there are two types of answers, two answers that you can give. And the first one is we seek God because God requires that we seek, because he designed it that way. And we're going to take a look at a scripture tonight. You'll find it in the back of your programs. That's from Matthew 13. You can find it in the back of your Nightlife bulletin, or if the print is too small, you can read it up here behind me. That print is not very big, though. If you forgot your glasses tonight, we love you, and we'll pray for you after the service. God requires us to seek is the first answer. Here's our text. The disciples, Jesus' disciples came to him and asked, "Why do you speak to the people in parables?" You know what a parable is? A parable is a little riddle. It's a mystery story. It's a type of teaching that doesn't necessarily give you the answer. It is symbolic oftentimes. Familiar parables are like, you know, the sower and the seed. A sower goes out. He sows seed by the road. You know, like, what is Jesus talking about? I asked him about God, and he's talking about farming. Right? Well, the parable is supposed to teach us something, both symbolically or conceptually. That's what the parable is. Jesus replies, "The knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you guys, but not to them, not to the people that are listening to my parables, not to the crowd. Whoever has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. This is why I speak to them in parables." And then he quotes from the book of Isaiah. "Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. In them is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah, you will be ever hearing but never understanding. You will be ever seeing but never perceiving. For this people's heart has become calloused. They hardly hear with their ears, and they have closed their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn, and I would heal them. But blessed are your eyes because they see, and your ears because they hear. For I tell you the truth, many prophets and righteous men longed to see what you see but did not see it, and to hear what you hear but did not hear it." So when the disciples come up to Jesus and say, why do you use parables? Why do you teach with riddles? Why don't you just speak plainly? You know, why don't you just say what you have to say? Why is it so hard to understand you? Why are your sermons so difficult to understand? Which, coincidentally, is a question that many of you are asking right now. Why are your sermons so difficult to understand? Isn't that inefficient? You know, why does God make it so hard to learn about the kingdom of God, Jesus? And Jesus replies, first to them, he says, the knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you. Well, that's quite a phrase. The knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you. And therefore, you know, you guys are able to understand is sort of the implication of what he's saying. My rephrase of that would be, you guys have gotten it. You get it, right? So you guys are different. You know, to you, I don't need to speak in parables. To the other guys, I do. The knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given you, but not to them. Whoever has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. And whoever does not have, even what he has, will be taken from him. This is kind of like saying, if you get it, you'll get all of it. If you don't get it, you'll have nothing. Right? So he's talking about an it. He's talking about some kind of secret. We'll talk about what that it is. But the first thing this reminds me of is sort of my take on the fundamental value of California condors and ivory-billed woodpeckers and things like that, right? If you find them fundamentally valuable, then you will understand why I see the world the way I see it. If you don't get it, if you don't get that, then nothing I say will make any sense to you. It will just be blah, 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 woodpecker, blah, 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 condor. That's what it will be like. So Jesus is kind of saying this, you know, there's something. If you get it, you will get all of it. If you get it, you will see the world as I see the world. Okay, but what is it? What's he talking about? The knowledge of secrets that unlocks everything. Evidently, it was something that Jesus was unveiling at the time. You know, he doesn't spell it out. He just says, you know, you guys have it. You guys who are following me around, you guys have it. But he gives us a couple hints of what the knowledge of this, the secret knowledge is that allows Jesus to speak plainly to his boys. The first hint is his explanation of why he speaks in parables. Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. In them is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah. You will be ever hearing, but never understanding. You will be ever seeing, but never perceiving. For your heart has become calloused, he says of the people. The heart is calloused, and therefore they can't hear, they can't see. Jesus is saying essentially, I make it hard to understand. The reason I teach in riddles and make people think and scratch their heads so much is that no one will automatically get it unless their heart is uncalloused, right? Unless their heart is in it. Unless their heart is in it, they won't really try, you know. So it's sort of a litmus test. It's sort of like quality control for the intentions of the heart, right? He's not going to make it easy, right? Only the people whose heart is in it will understand what Jesus is talking about. There's something central about having an uncalloused heart, which is to say a feeling heart, right? It's a heart thing, Jesus is saying. And I have to be careful that I'm not giving away too much to people whose heart is not in it. Interesting that he puts it that way. And he gives us a further hint. He says to his disciples, your eyes see and your ears hear what many prophets and righteous men long to see in the past, evidently. That many of the great heroes of faith long to see, you guys have seen. So, congratulations to you. They long to see it, but you actually see it. So what's he talking? What did the disciples have that the great heroes of faith of the centuries previous did not have? You know, those of you who know the Gospels will know that Jesus' disciples were not necessarily the brightest pennies in the pocket, right? These were not particularly smart men. They didn't necessarily understand what Jesus was talking about. And they didn't necessarily understand all of the parables he taught, at least not at first, right? And sometimes they were actually at odds with Jesus. They tried to correct his ministry style. and stuff like that. Nevertheless, Jesus says, you get it. So whatever it is, it's not intellectual. What do they have that the greats did not have before them? And many of you have already skipped ahead of me. Obviously, what they have is Jesus himself. Obviously, what they have is a relationship with this fellow Jesus. And Jesus is claiming here that him being there in person with these guys was something that all the great heroes of the faith of previous centuries would have enjoyed. So Jesus is making a really, really big claim for himself. He's saying, me, I am the apex of history. You know, everybody who followed after God would have loved to hang around with me. And you guys get to hang around with me. You know, you have something special in that. Right? And more than that, he's saying, you've been willing to follow me. You know, at this point, they've been following Jesus around a little bit. You've been willing to hang out with me. You've been willing to be my friends. They've been willing to get in line behind Jesus and to do all these crazy stunts that Jesus had asked them to do, like heal people and cast out demons and all that stuff. In Matthew 13, a little later on, Jesus tells a particularly troublesome parable about weeds. We don't need to go into the parable, but it confused them, confused the disciples. So they come up to him in verse 36 of the chapter and say, it says, then he left the crowd behind and he went into a house. And his disciples came to him and said, explain to us the parable of the weeds in the fields. And I think this fleshes out how Jesus used parables with his disciples. He would speak in riddles, and you weren't supposed to understand. To get the answer, you had to go find Jesus and hang out with Jesus. You had to go to the source. And teaching with riddles was a way for Jesus to ensure that to get smart, you had to have a relationship with him. Right? You weren't meant to get the answer off the top. Right? Because Jesus' goals were relational. Right? You had to be a friend of Jesus in order to understand Jesus, right? And in the Christian worldview, you have to be a friend of God in order to understand God. If your heart's not in it, then you're not going to get it. Right? You're not going to get it. Let me ask you Christians, what is it you like about Jesus? What do you like about Jesus?
He's a good friend.
He's a good friend, okay? What makes Jesus a good friend worth having, you guys? What's that? He's loving. What else?
He's a model.
He's what?
Leading.
Leading. So it gives you somewhere to go. Provides some sort of direction. Something like that. That's good. The Savior. He died for us. It's an important function.
Reliable.
He's reliable. Yeah, if you think about it, if somebody asks you, what do you like about Jesus, you tend to relay personal qualities. You know, if you can say, quite reasonably, what do you like about Jesus? Say, Jesus is Lord! Yes, he is. But you hang out with him because he's Lord. You consider him a friend because he's Lord, or you do consider him a friend because he's, you know, loving, merciful, gentle, good to be with. You know, if he were Lord and a complete jerk, this would be a real drag, right? You wouldn't necessarily want to hang out with him. And I think Jesus, in saying, you know, the kingdom has to be relational, is making a distinction between religion and relationship. God requires seeking after him, because knowledge without relationship is just religion, right? It's just about mastery. You know, God, speak to me the mysteries of the universe, so I will be smart. You know, so I will be a master. So I'll never get caught off guard. You know, so I can construct the world as I wish to construct the world. And God says, no, 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 no. I won't do that. I won't give you any of the secrets of the universe unless you like to hang around with me, right? Because this is not about religion. It's not about mastery. It's about love. Love is the most important thing. So it's interesting. He speaks in riddles, and it has to do with that. That's why God requires it. If you don't have a relationship, you don't have any knowledge. That's the way the Lord set it up. All right, that's the easy part of why do we seek. But there's another one, which I think we have to think about more. And you get at it by asking the question slightly differently. You don't say, why do you seek? You say, why do you seek? All right? Because any relationship is very, very personal. Why do you seek God? What is it that makes you a seeker of God? One upshot of Jesus' teaching is that if your heart isn't in the seeking, you won't find. So this can be a good diagnostic tool for us. If you're struggling to find God in the world, even if you're struggling to find truth in the world, and you're stymied, you're having a hard time doing it, Jesus' teaching suggests that it's not how you're seeking that matters, it's why you're seeking that matters. Right? Let me explain. Usually, if we cannot discern the secrets of the universe, the meaning of life, and stuff like that, we think about how. What more do I have to learn? What questions do I have to ask? What philosophies do I have to master? And stuff like that. Jesus has said in his teaching to the disciples that really, God will thwart you in your search for answers until you are seeking after relationship with him. He won't give you any knowledge until you have a relationship. So if you're frustrated in your quest for knowledge and getting your world all sorted out, right? If you're one of those people that really feel like you need to cross your T's and dot your I's in your understanding of the world, you will be thwarted until you make friends with God. That's Jesus' teaching. So why are you seeking after truth? I think many of us start out seeking after truth because we want to understand. And many of us end up seeking after truth because we want to love God more. You see the difference? Isn't it an interesting kingdom that the Lord has established? It's very counterintuitive. Why do you seek? You know, I seek God because, and that's going to be a personal answer for you. What makes you like Jesus? I don't know. Some of you are friends with me. I bet if I asked you why, there'd be a variety of answers. Most of them misguided, but, you know, there'd be a variety of answers. You know, because you're such a snappy dresser. Yeah, because of my hair. Mutual affection for the ivory-billed woodpecker. Right? You'd all have different answers. If you are seeking mastery of knowledge, that's not good. Are you seeking mastery of knowledge? Are you looking to learn a lot, or are you looking to know him better? Are you looking to be an expert on God, or are you looking to be a friend of God? It's a difference, yeah? Why we do a thing often determines how well we do at it. In Christianity, there's a big role for personal testimonies. Have you noticed this? We had Jeannie stand up earlier and share her story about what she has found here, and I liked it. She says that I'm learning a lot about God. I'm learning not to put him in a box and stuff like that. I'd like to ask you about your testimony. Why do you see God? This is going to determine how much you understand and how much you grow. What do you like about Jesus? What caused you to seek God in the first place? Or are you seeking him at all? Are you merely seeking answers instead of relationship? I think this determines whether you're a religious person versus whether you're a lover of the Lord. Different. For me, my personal testimony has a certain flavor to it. I think that the basic problem that I faced in the world and the basic problem that humankind faced is not our ignorance of how the universe works. It's our loneliness. I think the basic problem of humans everywhere is not that they don't understand how best to govern the world. I think it's that they miss God. I would wager, I guess, that whatever has brought you here, your thirst for answers or knowledge, that if you look deep down, you'd find that you just miss God. You know? That you seek a relationship with Him that is immediate and personal. And that's what Jesus offers you in the kingdom of God. He doesn't offer you teaching that's going to expand your mind, at least not at first. That might come later. What He offers you is a personal meet. Get to know Me. And then you'll understand the world differently. Get to value Me and what I value, and you'll see the world in a completely different way. All of your fundamental values will change. And that's what makes you a follower, and that's the reason to seek. You know, your target is a relationship. It's also satisfying, a deep need, in my opinion. So let me ask you this question to sort of end and begin our reflection time. Why have you been seeking after God? What is it that has driven you forward? Confusion? Curiosity? Loneliness? And any of those things can be viable answers. But let me say, if God were offering you a relationship with Him, why would you be interested in it? And I won't answer that for you. That would be entirely inappropriate. So just think about that for a minute. Oh, we're going to take communion here in a second. Ian's going to come up and minister communion to us tonight. But let's just take a couple of minutes before then and think. Meditate in your own hearts. God is offering you a relationship. Why would you be interested in it? Now, whatever your answer to that question or the beginnings of your answer for the question, I just want to stress this point. The way you answer the question sort of determines the path of seeking that you're on. God is offering me a relationship. Why would I be interested in it? That determines the kind of seeker you are. That's how you begin seeking. So know why you're interested in it. That's why we seek. That's the answer to the question. That's why we seek. We'll determine how far you're willing to go in pursuing. We'll even determine your methods. So worth thinking about. Ian?